Hello, and welcome to this previously recorded webinar from Clear Law Institute. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some administrative items. If you'd like to download the course slides, please click on the Event Resources section on the left side of your screen. Most continuing education agencies require us to verify that you attend the entire course to grant you credit. If you are seeking continuing education credit, please note that there will be three attendance checks that will randomly appear throughout the webinar. You must click on these attendance checks to receive credit. Once you complete this webinar, your certificate of attendance will be emailed to you within about 24 hours. In addition, it will be automatically uploaded to your Clear Law Institute account. If you have a question for the speaker, please type it into the Q&A box on the left side of your screen. The question will be emailed to the speaker and you will receive a response in the next few days. If you experience any technical difficulties during the webinar, please try using the refresh button on the left side of your screen. You can also check the technical support tab, which contains tips to solve most common problems. If the technical problems persist, please call us at 703-372-0550 or email us at support@clearlawinstitute.com and we will do our best to assist you. If you are using Internet Explorer and have any difficulty with the audio, switch your media player by clicking the diagonal arrows below the presenter's photo in the top left-hand corner of your screen. We hope you find this webinar useful and informative.
I am ready. Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Evan Schwartz. I am the founder of Schwartz Law, and I'm here to talk to you about litigating long-term disability claims, both in thinking about what you need to do as well as doing it. And we're going to follow along the outline, of course, and we're going to start with what seems to be something that comes up in virtually every case, at least the need to at least verify whether or not the policy or policies that your client has are governed by ERISA. And this comes up quite frequently because if you are an insurer and you represent an insurance company, you're always looking for ways to have ERISA apply to the policies that are at stake or in issue in the case, because if ERISA does apply, you get a heck of a lot of benefits as a defendant, typically. The most important for a lot of defendants and a lot of insurers is that ERISA preempts state law. And so whatever claims you may have under a traditional state law, breach of contract, bad faith, emotional distress, punitive damages, attorney's fees, blah, 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 all of those are going to be preempted by ERISA, and basically the only remedies you will have are remedies that are prescribed by ERISA. Those remedies are limited to, number one, the benefits due and owing to the client and the ongoing obligation to continue to pay them, and if successful in the case, a plaintiff can make an application for attorney's fees and costs, and that is done via what we call the Lodestar method, which is hours for dollars. You don't get a contingency fee enhancement. Those are the only remedies available under ERISA. In addition, across the nation, the current law is that if ERISA applies, you don't get a jury trial. You get a trial before the judge. And there are also some other very, very significant advantages to ERISA applying, which involve the scope of review and whether or not the claimant is going to get any discovery, and the standard of review. If there is a discretionary authority provision in the policy, it will potentially put you as a claimant in a situation where you can only overturn the determination that was made by the claim administrator, plan administrator, i.e. insurance company, typically, if that determination is determined by the court to be an abuse of discretion, which means if there's some rational basis for the determination to deny or terminate your client's benefits and ERISA applies, and you have an arbitrary and capricious standard or a discretionary standard of review in the applying to the claim, it's going to be very, very difficult to overturn, and it's only if the claimant can demonstrate that it was an abuse of discretion by the person that reviewed the claim. There's a lot of other elements to ERISA, but just in going through that, you understand that there are going to be potential issues with whether or not ERISA applies, and if you're a claimant, you have to look very carefully because the defendant's going to be looking for any way they can to get ERISA to apply. Now, you also have to look at, you know, are you representing a client with one policy? Are you representing a client with multiple policies? And you may have a combination of both. So, and if you do, it's going to affect what you think about and what you do and how you do it. But getting into the question of whether ERISA applies, you need to start with some of the general rules about ERISA and the application of it. So ERISA itself generally applies to all employer-sponsored group insurance policies. So the typical situation is the policy was obtained by the employer, and your client, if you represent the claimant, has a group certificate issued to that individual that covers them under the group policy. If that's the situation, then it is more likely than not that the claim and subsequent litigation is going to be governed by ERISA. And that is, again, going to change what your thinking is if you have to litigate. Now, there is an exception. There's a couple of exceptions that are most notable to know about ERISA and its applicability, and that is ERISA applies to private employers. It does not apply to government. So typically, if you're dealing with the federal government, the state government, or a municipality, or a subdivision of a municipality, and there's group policies that are issued, those are not governed by ERISA. And in addition, church plans are typically not governed by ERISA. So those are situations where they're not, even though they are employer-sponsored plans, they're not governed by ERISA because the government determined that ERISA was designed to protect from unscrupulous business people and employers that would steal their employees' money, and it was deemed that government wasn't going to do that, and therefore ERISA does not apply. So if you have a plan that is, you know, federal, state government, or its subdivisions, and in many jurisdictions, school districts fall within that particular rubric of being outside or part of a governmental subdivision, then ERISA is not going to apply. The other place where ERISA typically does not apply are association plans. So if you are an accountant and you got your plan through the AICPA, that's not going to be governed typically by ERISA. So, you know, going to the American Medical Association or the AICPA or the New York State Bar Association or the American Bar Association or wherever it is that you, if you got a disability plan through one of those associations, that generally is not going to be governed by ERISA, and you're going to have the benefit of state contract law. There's also something called the safe harbor exemption, which I note here. It's a four-part test that can take what would otherwise be an ERISA-governed claim outside of ERISA. It's a very stringent test, and I'm not going to go into the details of it now. It's not something that frequently comes up, and it's very difficult to demonstrate, but it basically involves the employer's complete lack of involvement and the insured or beneficiary of the plan having paid for everything and done everything themselves. It's very difficult to establish. And so I'm not going to get into the details, but I will say this. Again, these are things you need to look at. And the number three we have here, shareholders and closely held corporations, you have a number of crafty defense lawyers across the country who have made the argument that a small, closely held business where the individuals themselves got policies that were designed to be individual disability income policies, but they got a group discount because members of the group decided to all buy the insurance, those in certain jurisdictions have been determined to be governed by ERISA, and you really have to look jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and there are a lot of kind of interesting facts about what that, you know, whether or not those particular policies are going to be governed by ERISA. And again, it's very important to understand, because if you're in a state with bad faith, so let's say, you know, the classic example of a state without bad faith and a state with bad faith, I always like to use the coasts. So the state of New York, there is no first party bad faith. The state of California, on the opposite coast, some of the best bad faith law in the country. So if a claim for insurance is denied in the state of California or California law applies to it, there are an enormous number of remedies available to a claimant in that state that are otherwise not available under New York law. And if you're a claimant, you want to take the benefit of those because there are accelerated damages, there's punitive damages, there's attorney's fees, there's emotional distress damages. There's just a whole host of remedies that are available if it's determined by a jury, ultimately or typically, that can be pleaded and proved to a jury, and you could get an award that far exceeds the value of the benefits under the policy. It's very powerful stuff. However, if ERISA applies and you're in California, California law is not applicable at all, and all those remedies go out the window. So it is very, very important for anyone who's evaluating these cases and trying to determine what the next steps are to make that determination. And I'll make one other point, that if it turns out that the policy that you're dealing with is governed by ERISA, the typical law across the country is that you need to, quote, exhaust your administrative remedies when a claim is denied or terminated that's governed by ERISA. If you, as a lawyer, are representing a client and you think it's a private policy and you just file a lawsuit, but you never appealed, as they call it in the ERISA business, is that if your claim is denied or terminated, typically you have to appeal. If you didn't do that, you could potentially have lost all of your rights and remedies under that particular claim for that client. Because if you fail to exhaust your administrative remedies, the case could be dismissed in its entirety by the court. The alternative remedy is that the court would deny or dismiss it as premature, and perhaps you'd be able to go back and appeal. But typically there are time requirements or time limits within which you need to appeal, and if you don't, it's too late. So it's very important to try to figure out, hey, wait a minute, does ERISA potentially govern this policy? Do I need to maybe appeal just to cover my client's rear end here and make sure that my client, you know, and me don't do something that causes a problem that can't be fixed? So again, the importance of understanding whether or not ERISA applies comes into play. And I can tell you that I'm involved in a case right now where the client was a resident of another state and had a group policy through one of the associations. The insurance company knew it was a group policy, but they tried to follow rules that made it look like ERISA applied. The client was a resident of a state without bad faith, but also had a home in a state with bad faith. And during the time of the claim being administered, we determined that the claim was not going to be governed by ERISA. We got the client to reestablish the client's residency in a state with bad faith, and because we knew the company was gunning to terminate the claim, and when they terminated the claim, the client had reestablished residency in a bad faith state, brought a lawsuit, alleged bad faith, and created an enormous amount of pressure on the insurance company, and the case is pending, so I don't want to get into the details of it now, but this is not the first time where I've had a client who either had an association policy or a policy not governed by ERISA, or even a private policy where they were looking to establish residency from a state without bad faith to a state with bad faith, and we strongly encouraged them to do so before the claim was terminated. And the reason you do it before the claim is terminated, because in many bad faith states, the termination of a long-term disability claim, when done in the state in which you live, triggers the bad faith remedies under that state's law. So California and Arizona are perfect examples. Bad faith is a tort. So even if you have a contract claim, the tort of bad faith will occur if the claim is denied or terminated, and it's terminated when your client is a resident of that state. And so that's come up for me in my practice 3 or 4 times where I've gotten the benefit of bad faith law that otherwise I wouldn't have had I not been attuned to that and attuned to the fact that the claim was not going to be governed by ERISA. So those are, you know, this was all during the claims process, and it's all part of sort of pre-suit thinking and pre-suit considerations before you go and file a lawsuit. So with that preliminary thought about just understanding that you've got this kind of interesting combination of potential applicability of ERISA, potential state law, which state's law, and do you have extra contractual remedies in the form of bad faith or otherwise that you can take advantage of, and how would you go about taking advantage of them if you can? Important things to consider as you are heading down the road of a lawsuit in these particular cases. Now, if you're on the insurance company side, typically the lawyers who litigate on the insurance company side are not involved in the claims process. So they don't really necessarily get to see or think through these types of issues until the case is in their lap. So a lot of that thinking, can be helpful to defense lawyers who are defending insurance companies, but in terms of moving the ball forward and helping a client, it's a lot of thinking to be done on the claimant side in particular. Okay, so let's move to litigation section, and we'll talk about early suit investigation interviews. So on the claimant's counsel side, before you file a lawsuit, you really need to do some due diligence. And some of your due diligence these days is relatively easy, some of it's always standard. So if you go to, item 1I, the idea that you're going to always want to see your client's policies and see what they are before you file suit, I mean, that's almost, an automatic requirement. You're going to file a lawsuit based on a contract. You want to know what the contract says and if there's more than one contract. Now, I will, caution that it's very important for claimant's counsel to make sure they know the full scope of what the claimant has in terms of insurance coverage, because there are all different types of long-term disability policies. So you have what we've talked about so far, your group policies. You have your individual policies. You also have, if someone is involved in a business, they might have business overhead expense disability insurance, or key person buyout insurance, just like life insurance. There is disability buyout insurance to buy out disabled shareholders and help companies move forward. So many, many, many companies, privately held, usually closely held companies, will have business overhead expense disability insurance and disability buyout insurance, and you need to make sure you ask those questions. In addition, a lot of people who have disability insurance also have life insurance. And often that life insurance is with the same company that has disability insurance. Sometimes it's not. But quite often, those life insurance policies will contain waiver of premium provisions if the insured is disabled. So as a lawyer representing someone with these disability issues, it's important to explore and find out whether there are any and all coverages that are out there that might be implicated by the client's disability, to make sure that the client has filed claims under them if it's appropriate to do so, and that if you're going to litigate, you make sure that you know whether your litigation is going to include all of those policies, include none of those policies, include some of those policies. Okay. In terms of pre-suit investigation, I have some listings here. I will say that a rescission analysis is always important in a long-term disability scenario. The reason is that, you know, rescission is something that the insurance companies look at very, very carefully when someone is pursuing a disability claim these days. And unlike life insurance, rescission under long-term disability policies, especially these days, can exist for as long as the policy is in force. So what I mean is, typical your life insurance policy world is, if someone stays alive for 2 years while the policy is in force, after 2 years, it doesn't matter what happens, the policy can't be rescinded, and that is across the country. In long-term disability insurance, that's optional, and most states can beyond the 2 years, say that the company still has the right to rescind or contest what they call the contestability clause, contest the policy if there were fraudulent misrepresentations concerning issues on the application. So the burden of proving and obtaining rescission gets a lot harder for the insurance company after 2 years when the policies are written that way, but it's there. And so if a client has an insurance in 2010 and they don't have a claim until 2020, it doesn't matter that it's 2020 if there is a fraudulent misstatements contestability clause in the policy, because the insurance company can still go back in time, investigate, and determine that they believe that there were material misrepresentations made by the insured, typically about their medical history, but maybe about their income or something else, and that they relied on that to their detriment in issuing a policy that they otherwise would not have issued. And they can seek to rescind the policy. So you as a lawyer, when you get these, always need to go through the application and talk to the client and make sure there isn't anything out there, or at least nothing that you believe is going to trigger a potential rescission problem, because that can be a game changer. Obviously, you know, whether or not someone's disabled or not is something you can fight about and maybe go to trial on, and so can whether or not there was a fraudulent misrepresentation. But if there's a strong grounds to seek rescission, that's a summary judgment case, potentially. And that's a major game changer on you know, what the risks are in evaluating the case, whether or not you want to take the case, whether or not the client, whether or not you want to represent the client on an hourly basis or some other basis, some contingency fee basis. You know, those are things that go into that consideration. So you've got to look at that when you are initially evaluating these cases for suit and for purposes of representing a claimant. And if you're on the defense side, typically the carrier may have looked at that already, but if not, it's something you're going to want to be looking at to see whether or not you have an argument besides, hey, client says client is disabled, insurance company says client is not disabled, and insurance company client, you know, that's, you know, the he said, she said, and the medical experts and everything like that. But what if there is another way out? And rescission is another way out. So that's a pre-suit investigation analysis for really for both sides in a way. Then there's checking out your client and making sure that the representations made to your client, made by your client to you as you evaluate the case and for purposes of whether or not you want to take it and the merits of the case, that there isn't anything inconsistent out there in the world, in cyberspace, inconsistent with what you're hearing from the client when you meet with them and speak with them. And so, as we all know, it's a world full of social media, and it's an open world, and it's not hard for us as lawyers now to go out and do a social media search on our own clients before we decide we want to represent them. Or for a defendant, when they first get a file, to do a social media search and see if they find anything interesting about the client or anything about the client's activities that might be inconsistent with the nature of their claim. So early suit investigation interviews of the client, social media searches, rescission analysis, looking at the policies are all something that I would say are, in my view, when I do it, mandatory before I'm going to go forward and litigate. The later things here about talking to a spouse or a family member or a colleague or a coworker or doctors may or may not be something that I want to do in advance of litigating or not. Depends on what comes up on the information that I have after I do, you know, the policies, the social media, the rescission analysis, and meeting with the client. If I have medical records that I think on their face are supportive of the client's claim, I may not need to, at least initially, speak to treating, diagnosing, or supporting physicians. And I may decide I don't need to speak to colleagues or coworkers, assuming I even could, or spouses or family members, unless they are participating in the initial meeting with myself and the client. But those are certainly all things that you can or should do if the circumstances dictate it. So that's some general information about, you know, knowing about your client and knowing what you're getting into before you get into it. Okay, on the litigation side, some of it I've already talked about and said. On the defense side, you know, obviously you need to get the entire file. You need to understand the scope of what happened in connection with the investigation. You need to evaluate the pleadings and the policy to determine whether or not you think there are interesting arguments that you can use either as affirmative defenses or maybe even early motion practice concerning, you know, whether or not you think maybe a case is governed by ERISA, whether or not you think, you know, whether or not you think you want to potentially, if the case is filed in state court, whether you want to remove it to federal court. I find in my practice, and when it comes to this, I'm only on the claimant side, but generally speaking, most of the defense counsel that I deal with and companies I deal with would prefer to litigate these cases in federal court. I think there are a lot of reasons why they want to do that. So even if they don't have a federal question jurisdiction in the sense that it's governed by ERISA or there's some other federal claim in there, they can always seek to remove on diversity jurisdiction basis, which for all of those who are unfamiliar involves a claimant parties on both sides of the V that are from different states and an amount in dispute in excess of $75,000. Now, depending on what circuit you're in, I've had success in getting cases that were removed remanded if I wanted them remanded to state court based on the amount in dispute issue typically because there is case law in the Second Circuit, for example, that the $75,000 in dispute has to be in dispute at the time of the lawsuit. And as we all may or may not know, it's all exclusive of costs and interest and et cetera. So it's the actual damages. And what that means is the insurance company needs to owe more than $75,000 worth of benefits to the insured at the time that the claim is filed, the lawsuit is filed. So it can't be that there's $60,000 owed, but the future value of all the benefits is worth $3 million. It doesn't matter. It only matters, at least in the Second Circuit, whether or not more than $75,000 is owed, not what's at stake in the future. And then, you know, that's, you have to look jurisdiction by jurisdiction to see whether or not the jurisdiction you're in recognizes that rule, that it's only the past amount due and owing that's going to count for diversity jurisdiction purposes. Then if you're in a state with extra contractual remedies and you're pleading all kinds of damages, I mean, that's going to take you well, you know, well within the bounds of the amount in dispute for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. So if you're a claimant, again, you need to be looking at, hey, if I file this in this court and I think that there may be diversity jurisdiction, I need to know what court that's going to get removed to and decide whether or not that's a court I want to be in or whether I want to go through the process of delay or whether I have an argument to stay in state court, then there's just a number of other things to think about. If you're representing the carrier, you just need to think about, hey, if this is in state court, can I get it into federal court, assuming my client wants me to get it there, which typically they do. You know, carrier's counsel, they need to know who the claims decider is once they get the claim file, and whether or not that person had final decision-making authority, and if they didn't, you know, who's going to be some of your potential witnesses? Was the investigation done by employees of the insurance company, the in-house medical, vocational, financial people? Was it farmed out? Was it farmed out pursuant to some contract? Was it a third-party administrator? All those things are things you need to sort of get your arms around as you're starting to think about how you're going to defend one of these cases. And so that's another important component of understanding these and dealing with them and getting ready as the cases progress. Okay. So I did a little overlapping here as we got into, but getting more into litigation, I did a little of this choice of forum stuff, and I can tell you that as a plaintiff or a claimant, generally speaking, you got to go state by state, but you know, most of the time, plaintiffs who are individuals and they're going after named insurance company defendants want to be in state court. But, you know, again, it really depends on the jurisdiction, because sometimes maybe state court and federal court don't vary all that much, but the jury pool in federal court is much better for a claimant than the jury pool in state court. The area from which they draw their veneer. And then you also have to decide, well, how important is that? You know, and how important is that to the case? I can tell you that, you know, if you're just using New York State and federal as an example, there are a lot of advantages to being in New York State court versus New York federal court in general. Number one, you don't have jury unanimity in state court. It's 5 out of 6, where it's 6 out of 6 in federal. In state court, you get surveillance materials prior to the claimant's deposition. In federal court, you don't. In state court, you don't have to disclose your experts typically until much closer to trial. You don't have to do it typically during discovery, although in New York state court, some of those rules have started to change. You typically don't have to disclose those experts and allow them to be deposed before trial, whereas in federal court, you do. So that means more expense, and defendants generally want those depositions of those experts because it gives them a better sense of, you know, where the case is going and gives the insurance company a better sense of what they want to do vis-a-vis strategy and settlement. It also is more expensive for a claimant to have experts disclosed and deposed. It's more expensive for the carrier too, but they don't seem to be as concerned about that. And on the other hand, their counsel get to bill for all of that activity, so they're not going to complain about that per se. But since the carrier seems to like it and it's more billing for carrier's defense counsel, you know, that's a practical reason why, hey, why not? My client likes it. I get to bill for it. All good in the hood. So those are, you know, that's just a brief summary of state versus federal in the New York world, but you have to look jurisdiction by jurisdiction to see what, you know, what that means to your client, what that means to your case, jury veneer, et cetera, et cetera. So looking at causes of action. So your standard, to me, your standard insurance recovery dispute, whether it's a long-term disability case or otherwise, is a breach of contract and a declaratory judgment. So in a long-term disability context, hey, you terminated my claim, you denied my claim, you breached the contract, and you owe me money. So by not paying me, you also breached the contract. Okay? But because disability insurance policies are, you know, what I like to call monthly installment contracts, show me in January that you're disabled, and at the end of the month, I'll cut you a check for January. Then you got to do that again in February. Prove to me you're disabled in February. I'll give you money at the end of February, beginning of March. So since it's a monthly contract, month to month, you're proving you're disabled and getting your benefits, and you're looking for continued benefits, not just the money that's owed to you, that's where the declaratory judgment comes in. You as a claimant want a declaration from the jury and ultimately the court that your client is totally disabled, they're entitled to their arrears, and they're entitled to their ongoing monthly benefits subject to continuing proof of loss on the contract, and that, you know, they have the right to come back to this court in the future in a truncated proceeding in the event that the declaratory judgment given by the court is violated by the insurance company. I want to be able to make a motion and bring them right back in front of Your Honor and force them to do what I believe they're required to do, which is whatever, continue paying my client, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a declaration of the rights and obligations of the parties. I want my premiums to continue to be waived, both now and into the future. So there's a number of different things where the rights and obligations of the parties need to be declared, which is why the declaratory judgment is an appropriate remedy in addition to breach of contract. I've recently had to litigate with one particular law firm. They keep moving to dismiss my declaratory judgment claims in the state of New York, saying that they're duplicative of the breach of contract. And I had one unfavorable ruling on that in one court, but since then I've gotten two or three favorable rulings that I am allowed to plead both breach of contract and declaratory judgment. But again, this is a sort of a state-by-state situation where you have to do an analysis. Of course, one of the other remedies that I talked about at length already earlier is bad faith. Again, you have to look at the state that you're in to see that there is a bad faith remedy in that state. And in addition, you sort of need to evaluate the facts and see whether or not you have a good faith basis to argue that the claim was denied or terminated in bad faith. And, you know, you're not always going to know for a certainty, but you can get a good sense from understanding what happened in the claims process. If you have a claim that the insurance company thinks is governed by ERISA but may not be, you have a right to get the entire claim file and see how the claim was administered by the insurance company, and determine whether you think they did so in bad faith, and whether you can plead it. But again, you're going to have to figure out, number one, what state's law applies to this, and two, what kind of extra contractual remedies are there in that state. You also have the deceptive actuses and practice claims, which exist under a number of different states' laws. Those are often difficult to prove. You can plead them relatively easily, but they're hard to prove. And I find quite often that they can become a distraction to litigating the merits of my cases and bring about unnecessary motion practice. So depending on the jurisdiction I'm in and depending on the conduct that I've seen by the insurance company, I'm very cautious about whether or not I want to bring extra claims and just engender a waste of time, a waste of motion practice, or a waste of money. I certainly don't want to make unnecessary motions for a client that's paying their bills, and I don't want to slow down the train on a contingency case with either pleading and or attempting to prove broad causes of action that may not be supported by the facts. So in those cases, if I was able to get some damning discovery, perhaps I might seek to amend rather than plead it out of the box. And that's, again, just something that needs to be considered. Continuing on here, we have emotional distress claims that, again, is based on state law. Punitive damages based on each state's particular law and usually flowing from bad faith. And again, you got to look to the state, and you got to know what the state's law allows and how it allows it. Then you have what I have here, pleading total versus partial or residual disability. So for those that aren't familiar with partial or residual disability, that's typically where a person is unable to work in their occupation, but or they can work in their occupation or in another occupation, they can't earn what they were earning before. So a lot of policies will say you can do some but not all of your pre-disability occupational duties, or you can do all of them but you can't do them for as long a period of time as you used to do. And that's because either you get fatigued or you're in pain or you're otherwise limited, your practice, you're a lawyer, you know, you try two cases a year, but everything else is pretrial litigation, and even though those trials bring you big money, you can't do them anymore, but you can still do all the pretrial litigation. So that's where you might be partially disabled, which will be based on a drop in your prior income, or residually disabled as opposed to being totally disabled. Now, I will tell you that pleading that really depends on the facts or circumstances of the case that you have in front of you. So the classic example that I want to give when I want to plead partial disability is when I think a client is totally disabled, the insurance company thinks they're partially disabled, but at the end of the day, the client has such a large drop in income that they're getting most, if not all, of the monthly benefit they would get if they were totally disabled. And so I want to take advantage of the fact that the financial exposure to the insurance company is almost the same, whether or not it's a total disability or a partial disability. And so I'm kind of like, well, I'm going to come at you with both barrels of the shotgun, because either way, I'm in good shape. And I've had claims that were denied, and I say, well, you say he's partially disabled, but if he's partially disabled, you know, he either stopped working or has such a drop in income, he's going to get the whole benefit. So either way, you have to pay. And that, you know, helps me in pleading it. It's a lower bar for me to prove at trial, and it really, really helps with engendering settlement. On the other hand, if the key to my client's case is proving total disability and I can't get anywhere on a partial disability claim, then it makes sense that I don't want to plead it in the complaint. So, for example, a lot of policies, especially the older policies, would have a lifetime benefit trigger for someone that's totally disabled, but they'd end at age 65 for anybody who was partially disabled. So if I'm trying to get lifetime benefits and the company's disputing it, they're typically going to dispute it because they say the person was partially disabled and therefore the benefits end at 65. So obviously in that case, there'd be no reason for me to plead partial disability if the trigger for lifetime benefits is total disability. So those are kind of sort of the simpler examples of, you know, when and why you might want to consider that. All right. So here we go. On the other side, you have some options. You know, I don't think it's extraordinarily hard to plead a long-term disability dispute, especially if you're just going to do a breach of contract declaratory judgment complaint. But when looking at the affirmative defenses, failure to state a claim is a typical affirmative defense. I typically believe it's a meaningless throwaway affirmative defense. Be that as it may, someone wants to plead it, I would say I wouldn't even bother pleading it unless I thought I had a basis to make a motion against it. But that, you know, defendants, you know, all figure, hey, it's another affirmative defense, and if I don't use it, I lose it, so I'm throwing it in there. Time limitations can always be an argument. You have time periods in long-term disability policies to give notice of claim. You have time periods in long-term disability policies to provide proof of loss or proof of disability. And you have time limitations in most disability policies within which you have to bring a lawsuit. And most policies that I've seen that are not group ERISA-governed policies will say that you have 3 years from the date that proof of loss is due to bring a lawsuit. That's typically a shortening of the contract statute of limitations in many states, which are often 6, 5, and 4 years. So they're cut down to 3 years. They've been determined by courts to be enforceable. So you just have to see where you're at and see what the client has done and see whether or not you have a basis as a defendant to raise that as an affirmative defense. There are certain conditions preceding in these policies, for example, providing proper proof of loss or proof of disability. And, you know, it's always important as a defendant to look at those and see whether there's some argument you have there. Exhaustion of administrative remedies is clearly one of them, as we talked about. Under ERISA, you need to appeal. And then performance is, hey, we gave you what you were entitled to, so we performed. It's another example. So you see, then we get to potential initial motion practice. I mean, for a defendant, you know, the first thing I would be looking at is if it's in state court, do I want to remove it? Do I want to see if it's governed by ERISA? Do I want to see if I have any basis to argue that, you know, there was a failure to exhaust administrative remedies or some other condition precedent or time limitation that I can take advantage of? If I believe that there are specific causes of action that should not be pleaded in the complaint, that are not available as a matter of law and might open up my client to broad discovery, I might want to consider moving against those and staying discovery until we get a determination. Moving to dismiss or strike a pleading, you know, you better have some really good grounds for it, but, you know, it's something you can do, and it might make sense depending on the circumstances. So that is definitely, you know, something that, especially on the defense side, needs to be looked at. Okay, so now I'm going to move into the discovery phase. So typical discovery in a long-term disability litigation is for the claimant is getting the claim file, okay? And if they get the claim file, they look at the claim file. Sometimes you might need the underwriting file, depending on what the issues are in the case. Certainly, if there is going to be a rescission issue or an issue concerning how the policy was issued, and that's a situation where you're definitely going to want an underwriting file. Where you're going to get into disputes with defendants as a claimant is when you want information regarding other insureds, information regarding reserves and reinsurance, and, you know, generally speaking, you might have a tough road obtaining that information unless there's a real controversy at issue that triggers the need for that. So I would say rescission is a classic example where an insurance company will typically say, hey, had we known that insured had a detached retina 3 years earlier, we wouldn't have issued them this insurance. And that's a classic example of, in my view, opening up the door to allow the claimant to explore the underwriting history of other insurers to see what was actually underwritten by the company for similar benefit amounts during the year that the policy was issued to the claimant. To say, okay, you say you wouldn't have issued it. Well, let's test that theory. Let's see what you did issue and what you didn't issue, what you actually did. That would be a place to get information regarding other insureds. But getting it, even in that scenario, but more so in other scenarios, can be very, very, very difficult. And so if you have, you have to be able to go into the court with a good faith basis and convince them that there's a good reason why you're going to want some of this additional information. As you see here, you know, some general things that you're going to want. Always ask for the training manuals. If there are any, you'll try to get those. Clearly, a claimant's medical history is going to be, you know, almost always a major source of dispute in a long-term disability claim. You know, not always, but almost always. So something to consider. And it's something that you're going to be exploring. And typically, that's going to be the defendant that's going to go out and want to get all the medical records, review the medical records, see whether those records lead to other records, and allow them to see whether or not that the client has either maybe a potential rescission problem or has a credibility problem or has some basis to be impugned for purposes of defeating whether or not their claim is valid. Here we have, you know, scope of paper discovery, claimant's history, claimant's occupational history, financial history. I can tell you in my experience in litigating these cases, typically, unless you're in a bad faith case, the breadth and scope of discovery that proceeds is usually against the claimant. The claimant is usually the one that's turning over all kinds of things. They got to turn over financial information. They have to turn over occupational information. They got to turn over medical information. They have to be, in a lot of ways, almost like an open book in order to, you know, comply with defendant's discovery demands and the discovery obligations that the claimant's going to have. Here, we're just talking about a few other areas of discovery. You've got, obviously, the subpoena power if you need to get some of that additional information. Surveillance is always going to be something that I, in all my standard discovery demands, ask for. And I want to know if it exists. I want to know whether there are written reports. I want to know whether there's video. I want to know whether there's anything else. And I want all of it if I can get it, certainly and preferably in advance of the claimant's deposition if possible. But it's information that's going to be very important for evaluating credibility and merits. And it's just key information. Let's see. So now moving into depositions, identifying whom to depose. Okay, so, you know, in your more simple type of case, so it's a medical case, you're litigating, you know, your client says they have a cardiac condition that prevents them from doing their job. The insurance company has an expert that says they don't have that condition that prevents them from doing your job. And so, you know, besides going about the process of verifying your client's occupational duties and gathering up your medical records, whether or not an injury or a sickness limits or prevents somebody from doing their job is typically, you know, a battle of the experts. And so there isn't necessarily an enormous amount of extra discovery on a straight up, is she disabled or not medical case. You know, the claimant's going to get deposed. You might have an adjuster from the company get deposed. You might have an in-house medical person get deposed. And then the rest of it's experts who opine on the medical condition and say whether or not you can or can't do it. Right? So unless you have a factually complex case, the scope of discovery could be very, very narrow on both sides. Obviously, if you're going to identify who you want to depose, you as a claimant want access to the claim file, maybe the underwriting file, to be able to go through there and identify the participants in the process. Always important. And, you know, if there are corroborative witnesses and you're the claimant, if you control those witnesses, you're not necessarily going to run out and try to take their deposition. You're just going to know they're there and available to you for trial or for motion practice if needed. If you're representing the defendant and you believe there are witnesses out there, you may want to go out and depose them and get some information and see what you can find out. So it really, you know, it's going to depend on the complexity of the case in large part. And there are a lot of discovery vehicles in any type of civil case. So you've got your subpoenas. When you want to subpoena non-party information, whether it's financial, medical, or occupational, I can tell you that the defense bar on the long-term disability side is always very, very interested in the financial aspects of the claimant to see whether or not they had a motive to either make the claim, to continue the claim, try to get maximum value out of the claim. And, you know, that's important information for them to gather to try to impugn the credibility of the insured. And it's fair game. When it comes to identifying, not just identifying who to depose, but location of depositions, you know, the bottom line is you got to work cooperatively. Depending on whether you're in federal court, you're in state court, there are rules about bringing in out-of-state witnesses. There are rules about where they can be brought to be deposed, whether they can be brought to be deposed. And you as a claimant, if you're a claimant's lawyer, you want to work with your defense counterpart to work the location of depositions out and not have some, you know, additional time-wasting battle that's unnecessary. Experts. So there's a number of different types of experts. I mean, in the world of long-term disability claims, there's all types of healthcare experts that you may need to use to shore up or improve your client's claim. You might need for those that are unfamiliar, a neuropsychological evaluation. I find that in my practice, we send a lot of clients out to be evaluated by a neuropsychologist. For those that don't know what a neuropsychologist is, it is a particular field of psychology which allows the psychologist to have special training in testing the cognitive functioning of an individual. And because there are numerous types of claims that can affect cognitive functioning, we need to help measure those levels of cognitive functioning in order to help, A, corroborate the existence of the disabling condition to show that the client maybe lacks the appropriate level of functioning necessary to function in their job. So, you know, for example, executive functioning, which is, you know, sort of white-collar jobs. Someone needs to be able to think and process information and do all those things. If they're cognitively impaired, they're not going to be able to do that, and therefore they're going to be disabled. But the only person that's qualified to measure that and opine on the levels of the drop are neuropsychologists. So that's one form of expert. You know, and besides all the healthcare field, quite often you might need a vocational expert, an expert who can evaluate the occupation that your client's claiming they can't do and verify from a vocational standpoint that they cannot. Also trying to verify whether or not a claimant can work in some other occupation, not just the occupation that they're claiming to be disabled from, if that's relevant to the inquiry. And so a vocational expert can be extraordinarily important, and it's typically used in all cases by the insurance companies in the claims process when someone's occupational definition changes. So let's say they have a definition that says they'll be paid if they can't perform the duties of their own occupation, but after 2 years, they'll only be paid if they cannot perform the duties of any occupation for which they are reasonably fitted by education, training, or experience. And that requires a vocational analysis. So quite often you're dealing with, you know, a battery of healthcare experts along with a vocational expert to help ferret out and deal with the issues that you have in front of you when you're litigating one of these cases. And so extraordinarily important to think through who your experts may be and who's going to be needed to either defeat the claimant's claim or for the claimant to support their claim at trial. You know, what type of experts are going to be necessary, and then making sure that you have them on board. When it comes to the depositions of the experts, again, it depends on the court that you practice in. Typically, in New York State court, experts have not gotten deposed in the state court system before trial, but it can happen. There's also rules that prevent you in New York State court from taking the deposition of treating doctors as fact witnesses because, you know, it's incredibly burdensome and a waste of their time. And so the courts don't typically allow it, absent some very good cause. But those people can be your experts, and understand that if you're a claimant, you don't necessarily need to have a treating doctor as an expert. A treating doctor can come in and testify as a fact witness. And whether or not their opinions will be limited as a result of them not being officially qualified as an expert sometimes is played a little bit fast and loose in the state court system. So, you know, they may not necessarily need to be your experts. Okay? So, you know, after that you have your right by the insurance company to have an examination done. I'm losing my slides here. Where did it all go? Okay, here we go. Rule 35, examination of the claimant. The federal rules give an insurance company or a defendant in these medical circumstances the right to have the claimant examined. Now, that varies based on the case. A lot of times, in my experience, the defendants have already developed their case and have already had their medical experts look at it and make a determination the person's not disabled, so they don't need to come up with another expert. Need to have a Rule 35 examination. However, there are circumstances when they do. And just so you understand, if you're representing a claimant in a litigation against an insurance company, they want to do a Rule 35 examination of the claimant, that is something that can typically be negotiated in terms of location, in terms of duration, in terms of whether or not you or someone on your firm's behalf can appear with the client at the examination. And what their role will be limited to be if they actually do that. And so those rules, you know, generally that's to be worked out, but there are rules and the scope of rules to deal with that. Potential issues for summary judgment, I mean, again, you might have some form of a late notice defense. You might have a late proof of loss defense. You might have a contractual limitations defense. You might have a preemption by ERISA defense, and often there's discovery that needs to be developed before someone can actually determine whether or not they have a shot at winning on that motion. So, you know, these things are all variable, but they are potential summary judgment issues. Typically, whether or not a client meets the definition of disability is not a summary judgment issue. Typically, there's a he said, she said in there. There's medical experts pointing fingers at one another. So it's typically not a ripe issue for summary judgment. Summary judgment, I would say, would be reserved more for the game-changer defenses, like statute of limitations, like failure to exhaust administrative remedies, like late notice, late proof of loss, things of that nature. But once you've gotten through discovery, those are things that you as a claimant and or defense lawyer need to evaluate and determine whether you think you should make the motion and what the chances of you succeeding on the motion are. Okay. When you get to the point of trial preparation and trial, obviously, just like any trial, things intensify. I think it's very important for you as a claimant and as a defendant to have a theme about which you want to present to a jury or to a trier of fact, if that happens to be a judge. And so it's very, very important to think about as early on as possible what the theme of your claim and your case is, how you want to present it, and that's going to help dictate what witnesses you want to bring in and what order you want to bring them in and how you want to handle all of that. So having a theme and having a general idea of how you want to deal with that is for purposes of trial is very, very, very important. At the end of the day, in my experience, the vast majority of these cases do not get tried, but my firm over the years has had to try a few, and we've also brought a couple to the brink of trial. So it's not like it's never going to happen, and even though it's a less likely scenario than a settlement or other dispositive resolution, it comes up, and like any case, as we all know, could end up at a trial, and you have to be prepared to do what you need to do when the time comes. And if you're a claimant, if you're prepared to do what you need to do, the other side knows about it, and that will enhance the likelihood of a settlement. So you need to do it just to improve your settlement statistics. But these trials, I mean, one of the things that people should understand about these trials is the vast majority of these cases rise and fall on the quality of the facts and testimony of the claimant. The claimant is the star of this particular production. They're the ones that claim to be disabled. They're the ones that claim they can't work in their occupation or they can't work in any occupation. They have reasons why they can't. And they are going to be the ones that the jury's going to be looking at most closely to determine whether or not they accept and believe the claimant. So it's really that's the critical part of these cases. They can rise and fall on whether the jury likes and or believes the claimant. And so you as a claimant's counsel need to make that assessment yourself in the early stages and groom the client throughout the process to get them ready to be the star of the show. Defendants typically are going to get that deposition of the claimant, and they're going to assess the claimant at that point in conjunction with whatever paper records they have and determine what they're going to do. These cases typically don't fall and rise on the insurance company witnesses, even if one of them is argued to be a bad actor in the process. So that's the other thing I'll say for now about trial. Okay, so we've spent a lot of time and did spend a lot of time on already issues in ERISA cases, but if you scroll through a little bit of this, I just want to review, you know, your state law claims are going to be preempted, and you need to plead the right for your counsel fees, and you're going to have to make a motion for them if you're going to get it. On the entitlement discovery front, it's really, really variable depending on the judge you're in front of, the jurisdiction, and whether or not there is a discretionary authority provision in the policy which is going to require the court to only overturn the determination of the claims administrator if the court finds the determination to be an abuse of discretion. If that discretionary authority provision is in the policy and it applies, It may mean that you as a claimant get no additional discovery beyond the claim file, and that your case is going to be decided on a big fat motion for summary judgment. And while it's my firm belief that the vast majority of these cases are cases that should go to trial, there are many, 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 many cases out there where district court judges have ruled and they have been affirmed in determining that the determination of the claim administrator or insurance company in this particular case, while questionable or while not necessarily the perfect outcome, was not an abuse of discretion, was not arbitrary, was not capricious, and therefore we the court cannot overturn the determination that was made by that insurance company. And so that's what puts a lot of these claims in the graveyard forever, is that discretionary authority provision. If it's in there, the court's going to say, well, what do you need discovery for? You know, at the end of the day, we just have to decide whether this is an abuse of discretion. Get the claim file, look at it, agree that's the claim file, and make motion and cross motion for summary judgment. And we'll determine whether or not it was an abuse of discretion. As I said earlier, no one's entitled to a jury trial under these claims. I personally think, and my partner Michael thinks, that that's a mistake, and I think that we think the law is wrong, because they've tried to determine that these ERISA claims are so-called, quote, equitable in nature. But for now, that's the law of every circuit. It was never tested in the U.S. Supreme Court, but that's the law in every circuit. I have up here motion for judgment on the administrative record. That really is a misnomer for what is now called summary judgment and has always been called summary judgment. So if somebody can get summary judgment, they can get summary judgment. So what I want to say as we get close to wrap-up time is that when you are looking at these types of cases, they're a unique combination of medical, vocational, and personal claims, and proving them up and then navigating your way through this crazy world that marries potentially a federal statutory scheme called ERISA and its implementing regulations, various aspects of state law, and harmonizing it with financial issues, occupational issues, and medical issues makes these complex claims that require a lot of planning and thinking in advance before you decide to go out and put that complaint in the courthouse. And so, you know, I've come across so many claims throughout my career where I determined that it was premature for the client to file a lawsuit, that there are things that needed to be done. And understand, if ERISA governs your claim, you're typically required to file an appeal. But if your claim is not governed by ERISA, as far as I'm concerned and as far as the insurance companies are concerned, the claims process is open until the contractual limitations period runs or the statute of limitations runs. So you can always submit additional information or try to fix something that was messed up on the original claim or needed to be supplemented first before filing suit. You just have to evaluate that and make a determination as to whether or not doing that makes sense, is necessary, will potentially generate a positive outcome or a positive response. And so those are evaluations that you need to have before you just run out into the courthouse and file a lawsuit. So if you can fix it in claim, you can fix it in claim. And I always say, if there's a way to try to fix something in the claims process, you should try to do it, or at the very least, position the claim in that way and give the insurance company an opportunity to reconsider it, because they might just do so. And so they're fun cases to litigate, because you get contract law. You're suing an insurance company directly, so you're not dealing with the typical liability claims of, let's say, injury-based claims. But you've got this melange of federal law, contract law, medicine, financial, vocational, that can all be brought to bear. and you have to sort of weave your way through it and decide how best it is to approach it if you're a claimant and how best to poke holes in it if you're a defendant. And so having said all that, hopefully that's enough for all of you to sort of think about these cases and think about what you may or may want to do, or at least issue spot if you ever get one. I wanted to thank you very much for listening, and thank you all for your time today. And I don't know what information is available here to you, but if anybody needs to reach out to me at any time with a question, they can email me. My email is available on my website, www.schwartzlawpc.com. Thanks very much, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you for listening to this webinar. Please complete the course evaluation by clicking on the first link on the screen. Your continuing education credit will be emailed to you within 24 hours. You can also access your certificate in your account. As a reminder, if you have not indicated in your account what type of credit you will be seeking, please do so now. Because you purchased today's webinar, for the next 7 days, you can sign up for a yearly all-access membership for $599. All-access members can view an unlimited number of live and on-demand programs for 1 year. Register within the next 7 days using the promo code 7MEMBER to receive the $200 discount. If you have any questions, please contact us at info@clearlawinstitute.com or call us at 703-372-0550. Thank you.